From Arizona to Indiana, Kentucky to South Dakota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as the U.S. economy begins to recover from the coronavirus shutdown, the debate over government stimulus heats up. Adam Michelle from the Heritage Foundation is here to explain why more federal intervention could hinder the recovery. South Carolina and Georgia held primary elections this past week. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story on the results. Qualified immunity. What is it, and is it anti-police to support reforms? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores the issue with Clark Neely of the Cato Institute. And stressed out over concerns and restrictions resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says, try turning to nature. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Signs of economic recovery are beginning to emerge as states loosen restrictions put into place to fight the coronavirus pandemic. But government could get in the way of the rebound. Adam Michelle is a senior policy analyst with the Grover Herman Center at the Heritage Foundation. He is here to talk about the current state of the economy and the recovery. Adam, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Adam, as a result of the economic shutdown that was forced upon the country in order to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, we are now in an economic recession. For those who are not really familiar with all these economic terms, what does that really mean?
Recession means a couple of different things, but at base level, it just means that the economy is not doing very well right now. Some people define it as two quarters of declining GDP. This most recent proclamation of us in a recession doesn't quite meet that standard, but we're pretty sure that we're going to see a downturn over the next several quarters, which brings to an end the longest running economic expansion in our history at 128 months. Which is a pretty historic thing to come to an end.
As it does come to an end and we look at the economy recovering, we are seeing a resurgence in the equity markets. They've regained most of the very steep losses that occurred back in March and April. Is this a sign that the economy is indeed recovering, or maybe are the markets getting a little ahead of things?
So it's more than just the markets. The May jobs report that just was released this past Friday shows that the economy is actually starting to add jobs again. 2.5 million jobs were added. The unemployment rate started to look better rather than looking worse, as most economists had predicted. So there's glimmers of hope. We've, I think, hit the bottom of this downturn, and we're starting to come back. But there's still 20 million Americans that are unemployed, and there's still a long way to come as we climb our way back to the historic prosperity we were seeing at the beginning of this year.
The federal government at the beginning of this shutdown that was pandemic related did pass the Federal CARES Act. It was a gigantic stimulus program. I'd be interested in your thoughts as to how effective you think that stimulus has been and whether it's positioned us to emerge from this downturn.
The federal government has done a tremendous amount to support the economy while it was closed. Congress has authorized, I think, close to $3 trillion of new spending. The Federal Reserve has taken unprecedented action. And a large portion of that should be thought of as a sort of safety net for the economy to cushion the bottom of that trough while governments were telling businesses they weren't legally allowed to operate. But we shouldn't think of all of that spending as the reason that the economy is now hopefully showing signs of rebound. Sort of cushioning the bottom of a downturn is very different than being able to stimulate additional economic activity going forward. I think the glimmers of hope that we're seeing, the good jobs numbers, the turnaround in the stock market has more to do with people starting to go back out and spend the money that they've that they haven't been able to spend over the last several months. It's about people being more comfortable with the new normal and internalizing the risks that are still out there amid the current pandemic.
We had that stimulus package. In fact, there have been several of them. And there has been a lot of talk about whether there needs to be yet another stimulus package. Members of the Trump administration have put the brakes on that, said we need to let what's already been done perk through the economy more. In terms of a new stimulus package, Adam, do you think it's a good idea for the federal government to take additional action? And if you do, what form should that be?
The initial spending that we've seen, I don't think we should think of that as stimulus. All government spending and intervention has costs, and policymakers have simply decided that the immediate benefits of people having more money in their pocket, being able to make rent today, outweigh any cost of paying that money back in the future or any distortions that may cause across the economy. So moving forward, if we think about additional government stimulus in the traditional sense of how do we jumpstart the economy and get things moving again, we know from historical evidence that governments are not very good at that second piece, at restarting the economy. Instead, governments should be getting out of the way and letting the private sector get back to normal, to start hiring people back, allow the American people to drive that recovery rather than the government trying to direct it. We saw the failure of stimulus in the 2008 recession, that we saw a failure of similar spending proposals in past recessions and across the world, across different time periods. Economists have looked at these things, and they simply don't pay off in the way that a lot of people think they should. So what Congress should be doing right now, what state governments should be doing right now, is removing restrictions that are keeping businesses from reorganizing and retooling for the new economy, removing licensing restrictions and unnecessary regulations that make it harder to do business. These are the types of things of government getting out of the way that I think can be most effective right now.
You mentioned that we took these short-term steps because we view them to be more important than the long-term steps. But looking long-term, all the debt that has been added in order to pay for the CARES Act and other steps the government's taken, what impact do you see that having on the economy and on the federal government going forward?
The impact of the steps we've taken recently will be long-lasting and with us for quite some time. It's more than just the debt. It's what all that spending is doing throughout the economy, the support, the loans and grants to small businesses, the subsidized loans to big businesses. All of these things come with strings attached and come with distortions to the economy that will ultimately make the recovery to whatever our new normal looks like slower and not as efficient as it otherwise would be.
We have been talking with Adam Michel, who is a senior policy analyst at the Grover M. Herman Center, that at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Adam, tell us a bit about Heritage, and you've written extensively on these subjects, so where can folks go to read your writings?
I've surveyed the evidence of past stimulus measures and looked at these issues pretty thoroughly, and all that writing is at heritage.org. The Heritage Foundation is a full-service public policy think tank in Washington, D.C.
Adam Michel from the Heritage Foundation. Adam, as always, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth continues to track the state-by-state primaries that are occurring around the country. We've had primaries in South Carolina and Georgia over the last week or so, so we're going to turn now to Scott to get an update on those races. Scott, welcome back to American Radio Journal.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Let's start out in South Carolina, and there was a key congressional race in South Carolina 1. To give our listeners a little bit of perspective, tell us about the historical background of that district, and then we can talk about what happened this past Tuesday.
Representative Mark Sanford became governor of South Carolina, and then he, you know, got into this affair, and then he had to run for his House seat again, and he became a congressman. And then he got primaried by a woman named Katie Arrington. Katie Arrington beat him in the Republican primary election on June 12, 2018, with 50.6% of the vote, a very, very tight election. But the issue there was she ended up losing the general election to Joe Cunningham. So Joe Cunningham is the first term Democrat in that race. It's a PVI of R plus 10, meaning this is usually a seat that should be safe Republican, right? It's a big, big target for Republicans to win back in the 2020 elections, especially because we know that South Carolina is going to be in President Trump's column come election night. So we're targeting Joe Cunningham in a big way, and there was a very, very competitive election for the Republican nomination in that congressional race. Club for Growth, PAC, had endorsed a woman named Nancy Mace. She was a state representative and the first female graduate of the Citadel. The good news for her is even though she had a very, very competitive primary against a woman named Kathy Landing, Nancy Mace finished above 50%. She got 57.5% of the vote, and she will avoid a runoff. Therefore, she will take on Joe Cunningham on November 3rd head-to-head. That saves us a lot of resources avoiding a runoff race there, and we're very excited about the prospect of Nancy Mace. This week, President Trump went ahead and announced his endorsement of Nancy, so we're excited to have him on the team, too.
Very good news out of South Carolina. Let's turn to the neighboring state of Georgia, where there actually were two House races that we've kept a close eye on here over the last few months. Tell us a bit about those races.
The first one is an open seat, a big, big, bright red Republican district. And this is Georgia's 9th congressional district. This is vacated by Doug Collins, who's running for the United States Senate for the open race, vacated by Senator Johnny Isaacson, who announced his retirement late last year. The governor, Brian Kemp, did appoint Kelly Loeffler to the seat to fill out the rest of this term, but it creates what's called a jungle runoff. So if nobody gets 50% on election day in November, the top two vote getters will advance. So it's sort of a quirky election rule that's specific to Georgia's state laws on election. And we're excited to see how that Senate race shakes out later. But in the interim period, it created an open race in Georgia 9. And this was, again, one of those really, really competitive primaries. Club for Growth PAC had endorsed a young man named Matthew Gertler, and Matthew Gertler is the most conservative state representative in the entire state, and he ended up getting about 25% of the vote and finished in first place, but obviously didn't reach 50%, so he's going to advance to a runoff against another very conservative man named Andrew Clyde. Clyde is a veteran and the owner of a gun store there in Northeast Georgia. And so that's going to be a big, big race. The runoff will be on August 11th. Going back to sort of the Atlanta area in Georgia's 7th congressional district, Club for Growth PAC had endorsed ER doctor Marine named Rich McCormick. We endorsed him earlier in February. He was one of our favorite candidates of the entire cycle. And the good news about this race is McCormick avoided a difficult runoff election on August 11th because he finished with over 50% of the vote. And he will advance to an open race against the Democrat on November 3rd. This is a seat that Rob Woodall previously held, and Woodall only won re-election by a couple hundred votes in the 2018 election. So after that, he announced that he would retire following the end of this session. This is not a bright red district like Georgia 9, but it is one that we think Rich McCormick has the experience and credentials to be a really, really competitive candidate, and we fully expect him to be sworn in as a representative next January.
Scott, we've looked at these individual races. Let's go up to the bird's eye view now. Overall, of course, Democrats do control the U.S. House of Representatives. Just as a general trend, how are things looking at this very early stage as we begin now to turn to the general election cycle?
Candidly, I think that it's tough for Republicans. We need to have enthusiasm behind the top of the ticket with President Trump. We need to have enthusiasm down ballot for these important positions in the federal government. the bottom line is, when we lost the House in 2018, that empowered Speaker Pelosi to politically damage President Trump through the impeachment. And I firmly believe if President Trump is reelected and Democrats maintain control of the House of Representatives, he'll set history by being the first president to ever be impeached twice. What will he be impeached for? I have no idea. It doesn't really matter. This is why elections have consequences, and we need to make sure that we're putting all of our efforts into winning back the House majority and maintaining the United States Senate majority. But those races are also very, very difficult in the Senate. We've got a lot of vulnerable senators that are incumbents throughout the country. I think the Democrats have done a decent job in recruiting, especially in states like Montana and Arizona. And those are going to be highly expensive races. And we have to also be fair with the facts that over 40 million people lost their job due to the coronavirus pandemic. Some of them are getting back into work, but this week we learned that there were still over 1.5 million new job loss claims in the last week. So looking at things sort of from that top line perspective, I'm worried about what the election looks like on November 3rd, but we've got a lot of time to turn things around. Political winds shift all the time.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
So today I've really talked about Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action. Club for Growth PAC is the membership organization that makes endorsements through Club for Growth of federal candidates. And then Club for Growth Action is our super PAC. Club for Growth also has its advocacy membership organization of over 300,000 Americans from all 50 states in the country. And if you're interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, good to have you. Take care.
Thank you.
One area of law enforcement reform where something of a consensus is beginning to emerge is changing qualified immunity. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Clark Neely of the Cato Institute.
In the wake of the protests that erupted across the country after the brutal killing of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis a few weeks ago, there have been a lot of ideas thrown out there about how to fix or reform policing in the United States. One of the more serious and I think more important ideas has to do with something called qualified immunity. This is a legal doctrine that makes it very difficult for victims of police brutality to get justice and compensation in civil court if they are injured or if one of their loved ones are killed by a police officer. And it's something that Congress is now finally starting to pay some attention to. You're listening to American Radio Journal. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and joining me to talk about qualified immunity is Clark Neely, the Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. Clark, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Clark, qualified immunity reform is something that even Congress is now starting to get involved in, but there's a reticence, I think, from some on the right to embrace this idea, in part, I think, because it is somehow seen as being anti-police. There's only one Republican who has so far signed on to co-sponsor Representative Justin Amash's qualified immunity reform bill. And just this week, Attorney General William Barr said that he's concerned that if you rolled back qualified immunity, it would somehow cause cops to pull back or be less effective. I want to ask you about all of that, but perhaps we should start just by defining the term here for people who haven't heard it before. What is qualified immunity and how does it work?
Qualified immunity is a judge-made rule that is the cornerstone of our near-zero accountability policy for law enforcement. The statute that was actually passed by Congress just after the Civil War provides that a state actor, meaning somebody employed by the state or local government, including police, shall be liable to the person injured for the deprivation of any rights. And that's a broad and I think an appropriately broad standard of liability. But what the Supreme Court did was it just invented out of whole cloth this qualified immunity doctrine. And what it did was insert two words into the statute, in effect. And what they did was they changed any rights to any clearly established rights. And what that translates into is a requirement that before you can sue a police officer for doing a particular thing to you, for example, jamming his knee into your neck until you lose consciousness and die, you have to find a case in that jurisdiction where almost the exact same thing was done to somebody else and a court said that you can't do that. If that case doesn't exist, your case will be thrown out on qualified immunity grounds. That's how the doctrine operates, and it creates a nearly kind of impenetrable barrier to holding police accountable for rights violations.
I know there have been dozens of just really infuriating cases where police officers have behaved in ways that go well beyond what is an acceptable thing for a police officer to do. And then they end up in court and they basically just get away with it because they can argue that they had qualified immunity. We've covered lots of these cases at Reason over the years, and I know you've followed them pretty closely as well, Clark. Can you just give us a taste of how this works in practice?
I'll give you two quick cases. There's one case out of Georgia where there was a pursuit through a residential neighborhood. Police ended up tackling the suspect on the front yard of a family. The family happened to be outside playing at the time, so there's a bunch of kids and a few adults in the front yard. The police make everybody lie down in order to secure the scene. And just after the officer who tackled the suspect gets him handcuffed, the family dog comes from underneath the house to investigate. Dog is not barking, not threatening, not growling. But the police officer nevertheless draws his weapon, takes a shot at the dog, and misses. Dog goes back into the house. A few minutes later, it comes out again. Police officer shoots at the dog again. He misses again, but this time he hits a 10-year-old boy in the back of the leg, severely injuring him. And the boy was just a foot and a half away from the police officer. The family sued, and the Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, threw the case out on qualified immunity grounds, not because it was okay to cook off shots at a non-threatening dog on somebody's front yard full of kids, but just because that particular thing had not happened before. That's not, by any stretch, a kind of an out-of-the-ordinary example. That's just a day ending in Y for qualified immunity. The other example comes from Fresno, California, where a police officer was executing a search warrant at somebody's home who happened to be a coin collector. The allegation, which we have to accept at face value at this stage, is that the police officer simply helped himself to $225,000 in currency and gold coins, literally just stole it out of this guy's bedroom. The homeowner then sued the police officer, and once again, the Court of Appeals, the infamous Ninth Circuit, threw the case out on qualified immunity grounds, and I am not making this up. The court said the following: we may all understand that stealing is immoral, but we do not yet have a case in this jurisdiction that tells police that it is unconstitutional to steal somebody's property while executing a search warrant, so therefore qualified immunity applies, and the case is thrown out. That's also how it works, and it's appalling.
We are talking with Clark Neely from the Cato Institute. Clark, just about a minute left here, so I apologize for asking you to pack a lot into this final answer. There's this view on the right that reforming qualified immunity is somehow anti-cop, but it seems to me that holding bad cops accountable for stealing $250,000 from someone, it seems like holding those people accountable would actually improve policing overall, because most police officers are not going to do that, and it would certainly improve the public's trust of police officers too, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the law enforcement lobby is the second or third strongest in the country, and they are incredibly adept at spinning a web of myths and fictions about to get Republicans in particular all spun up. So one thing they'll talk about is, oh, you know, police will be at risk of losing their houses, no one will sign up to be a police officer, et cetera. And this is completely preposterous, because it turns out that police almost never pay the damages for their own misconduct. Because they are indemnified by the department and or the city, it actually turns out to be the case that 99.98% of all civil rights payouts for police misconduct come not from police, but from the city, which means us, the taxpayers. So that's just one example of the many fictions that the law enforcement lobby essentially tries to get Republicans all spun up by. But once you look past the fictions, this is a really solid policy. We really should get rid of qualified immunity.
Yeah, obviously, just one of many things that could or maybe should be done to improve police accountability. But this seems like a slam dunk to me. Seems like an easy way to improve that accountability through the court system, and in line with, as you said, in line with Congress's original intention. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today to talk about it. Clark, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And again, that is Clark Neely, the Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. You can check out his work and all the fine work that they do at cato.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check us out at reason.com, and you can catch me again next week right back here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A walk in the woods or other time spent in nature is a great way to relieve stress generated by all those COVID-19 pandemic restrictions. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Life in nature, said Thomas Hobbes, is nasty, brutish, and short. And so is life for too many people that are infected nowadays by COVID-19. And yet, nature can offer refuge if people seek out its best use. Social distancing during a time of pandemic should prompt us all to rediscover what nature can offer. Go outside, walk in the woods, find a creek, go alone, with a friend, with a family. Over the weekend, I went to the creek with my three youngest. One is 5 years old and the others are 9 and 10, just a few months apart. Yes, my wife and I have two born only a few months apart, unusual even for a couple of natural family planning Catholics. But that's because the 10-year-old is adopted. In fact, two of those three are adopted, given the gift of life by a single mom who couldn't raise them. And we, all of us spiritual children, well, we're all given the gift of God's creation. To observe three kids cutting loose in a creek is a happy, joyful experience. Away from TVs, phones, laptops, and handheld video games, they have way more fun wading in water than surfing the web. In fact, surfing is a choice word. They actually try to surf in the creek. I'm not kidding. They do all sorts of crazy things. They jump, flip, skip rocks, slop mud, dunk, soak, even in temperatures barely above 70 degrees. It doesn't matter. They have a blast. And you know what? So can you. I've encountered way too many adults during the social restrictions of this pandemic who seem unable to find peace and consolation. They speak of current life as nasty and brutish, even as this period in which we've been asked to sacrifice, well, is actually pretty short. But their lack of peace is worse than that. Daily, I receive emails from frustrated friends comparing pandemic-restricted life in various states to totalitarian dictatorship, even a life under the Nazis and Soviets. Many of these are from dear friends that I respect and who ought to know better, who've never been naive to how bad life was behind the Iron Curtain. Needless to say, what we've been asked to do nationwide since about mid-March has no resemblance whatsoever to East Germans behind the Berlin Wall and at the hands of the Stasi. Life in many of our counties clearly is flatly not comparable to life in the Gulag Archipelago. When I lecture on the stretch of life in America from World War I and the Spanish flu through the Great Depression and World War II, I always observe to my students that I fear our modern culture could never endure the sacrifice and hardships of another world war or depression or plague. And now, I'm absolutely convinced of that. Now, let me say this. I totally understand the anxieties of people right now. People are losing jobs. Parts of the economy certainly should be reopened. Personally, I've lost a ton of money the last couple months. From my retirement account, investments, lost income. Next year, for me and my wife, will be year 5 of roughly a 24-year run of having at least two kids in college simultaneously. We're all losing money right now, some worse than others. I get it. Please, don't be angry with me. But for now, my point, I urge people, find contentment. Find peace. There's literally a beautiful world out there. Life in nature need not be nasty, brutish, and short. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXEX-AM, KGED-AM, and KQEQ-AM in Fresno, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.